Okay, good morning. This is Bio 231, Monday, August 24th. We're going to finish up the cell and move on to histology today. And here's a sign-in sheet, so make sure you pass the sign-in sheet around. Sign it. Don't sign it for a friend, because you'll get in trouble. Just sign your own name around right there. And, okay, does anybody know if you're going to drop the class? This is probably the last time I'm going to ask, because we're trying to just maximize enrollment, right? We're trying to get students in. So are you going to drop the class, or do you know anybody that's going to drop the class that hasn't told me? Okay. That's excellent that you all are sticking in there, doing your homework and that kind of stuff. So I'm sorry, everybody is still here. Thanks for checking. Okay. All right, so you should be doing your pre-lecture reading assignment. You probably got some quizzes in lab this week, and then next week you have a practicum in lab already. So I'll go over that material with you. I don't think I need to say anything else other than everybody hold up their pre-lecture reading assignment. Completed, not just blank. All right. Very good, very good, very good. I like it, so be prepared every time to show off your good work. And remember, only officially registered students in class. And if you have problems logging on to Blackboard, all right, you got to make sure that you let me know. I gave you a bunch of materials already, hard copy, but from now on, you're going to have to go to Blackboard. You're going to have to go to Blackboard and download them yourselves, unless that's a big problem for you. Then I can help you do that. Okay, I did have some questions regarding where the lectures are, because don't forget I record the lectures, and I didn't get anything in written form from somebody saying they don't want the lectures recorded, so I'll record the lectures, put them online. This is where you find them online. That's the URL. That's in your course syllabus. And, of course, what do you have to do? You want to go to Bio 231, Human Anatomy Lecture, and then here are the fall lectures. On the right-hand side of the page, click on that, and here are will be all of the lectures. I erased links to everything that's for Chapter 1, and then I'm starting to relink the lectures as I record them. All right, there's also a text file that is associated with that WAV file, so you can read through a file that's similar to the lecture that I'm giving this this semester, but it's from a previous semester. All right, anybody got any questions on that kind of stuff? These links are in your syllabus, and if you get those in your computer, they're executable links just by hitting Control, and then you can click on that link that's in the syllabus. It will take you to those websites. All right, so we were talking about protein synthesis, and where does protein synthesis take place? Because we're talking about cells. So there are three main regions, okay, of a cell. You've got the outside world and then the inside living world. That's separated by what organelle? You should actually think of it as an organelle. It's a little bit strange that I phrase it that way. But what separates the inside living world from the outside world? The plasma membrane or cell membrane. That's a very important organelle, actually. All right, so what are the three main regions inside the cell membrane? You've got the cytoplasm, right? You've got cytosol, and you've got the nucleus. Those are the three main regions. All right, so cytoplasm is really cytosol with organelles in it, and you could actually think of the nucleus as being an organelle if you want to. Right, but those are the three main regions. So where does protein synthesis take place? Okay. That's kind of a complicated question, because how many steps does it take to make a protein? It takes two steps, and you should know their names. The first step, and it has to happen first, is what we call transcription. So where does transcription take place? That's inside the nucleus, right? So when I ask, where does protein synthesis take place? That's kind of a loaded question, because it starts in the nucleus with that step called transcription. And transcription is a step that takes information in DNA and converts it into RNA. We call that transcription because the language is basically the same. The language that DNA molecules are made out of are nucleotides. It's a nucleotide language, and the language that RNA is made out of is a nucleotide language again. That's just the building blocks of RNA and DNA. So if you take information in one language and make another copy of it in the exact same language, what do we call that? You could say, oh, well, that's making a photocopy of something, which is transcription, right? Making an exact duplicate copy is transcription. Then the RNA leaves the nucleus, and it goes into the cytoplasm. RNA then interacts with a little tiny organelle. What's that little tiny organelle that RNA interacts with to undergo the final step in protein synthesis? It's got to be a ribosome, right? It's got to bump into a ribosome. And ribosomes can be in one of two locations, freely floating around in the cytosol. We call those, ribosomes. Free ribosomes are on your diagram of the cell, figure probably 2.1. And then there are ribosomes associated with endoplasmic reticulum. And therefore, we call that kind of endoplasmic reticulum, you just told me a second ago, but yeah, the rough endoplasmic reticulum, because they have ribosomes on them. And ribosomes are the workbench where RNA is used to assemble a protein. And that step, where RNA is used to assemble a protein, or when we take information in RNA, convert it into information in a protein, is what we call translation. Okay, and that's translation because what's the language that a protein is made out of? What's the basic building block of a protein? Amino acid, right? We didn't cover that in this class, but probably most people know that when they get into this class just from being around, all right? And the building block of RNA is nucleotide. So if we go from a nucleotide language to an amino acid language, two totally different languages, and when you go from one language to another, you need to translate. Right, so that's why we call that step translation. That's like going from Spanish to Farsi, or English to Hebrew, or who knows what, right? All kinds of different ways of going. But what about the information? Should it change, even though you're going to different languages? Should be the same information, right? So that's really what translation means. That does not happen in the nucleus. That happens in the cytoplasm. Okay, and there are three different kinds of RNA that are needed. Ribosomal RNA to make those little ribosomes up. And transfer RNA is a special kind of RNA that brings 20 different kinds of amino acids to the ribosome so that the ribosome could build the right kind of protein. You have about 20 different kinds of amino acids, and they have to be put in the protein in the right order to make that particular protein. Just like when you spell a word, the letters have to be, you can't just pick all the letters that are in a word and put them down on a piece of paper. They have to be in the right order in order for that word to have meaning. Same thing for a protein. The amino acids have to be in the right order in order for that protein to work properly. And the information that tells the ribosome what order that is what we call the messenger RNA. So I tend to think of the transfer RNA as like a little taxi RNA. It's bringing different amino acids to the ribosome, and the instructions on how to assemble that protein is contained in the messenger RNA, but a protein still can't be made until you have that workbench available, ready to make a protein, and that's due to the ribosomal RNA. Okay, so that's protein synthesis. Now in lab, we talked about cell division pretty extensively. All right, so I don't think I'm going to go over cell division here, or mitosis specifically, unless somebody has some questions about mitosis. I guess I've got some questions on here, or in my mind. What are two important reasons for mitosis? What are two important reasons for mitosis? Growth, that's one. Yeah, here's one, and then two. Replacement of old and damaged cells. So, for instance, at one point in time, when an egg from your mom and a sperm from your dad came together and formed a single cell, what was that process called? You all know, even though you might not be thinking about it right at the moment. What is that process called? Scientific process. When an egg joins a sperm and forms a single cell. That's fertilization. Yeah, that's just fertilization. So at one time, we were all just one cell, a single cell. And when you take a biology class, yeah, it's hard to imagine that you were just a single cell at one point in time way back when. All right, but we all were. When you take a biology class, you'll learn that the name of that single cell is called a zygote. So we were all just a zygote at one point in time. And although that's human life of some kind, right, it's not really all that exciting because a zygote really can't come to class and take notes and listen to lectures and take tests and stuff like that. Because what do you need? You need hands and eyeballs, right, and a brain and all that kind of stuff. Well, how do you go from a single cell to trillions of cells? That's a process of mitosis, right? There's some other processes taking place there, but when you go from a single cell to trillions of cells, that's growth. Mitosis is definitely necessary for that. All right, so you're lucky. You can come and take those anatomy tests and listen to anatomy lectures and things like that because you're no longer just a single cell. All right, the other reason, replacement of old and damaged cells. You don't have the same cells in your body that you had, say, 10 years ago or 15 years ago. Because cells die, they have to be replaced. So what kind of cells are you aware of that live only a very short period of time? You aware of any cells in your body that live for a short period of time? Okay, and a good example would be a red blood cell. Where do we find red blood cells? In our blood. That's why we name them red blood cells. And they're in our blood to carry oxygen all over our tissues. They're loaded with a chemical that carries oxygen everywhere in our body. And there's so much of that chemical in there that there's no room for any other organelles, including a nucleus, right? And that chemical is called hemoglobin that carries oxygen. So if a cell doesn't have a nucleus, it can't respond to any challenges. It can't repair itself because where does protein synthesis take place? It starts in the nucleus. Right, so if the cell doesn't have any nucleus, that cell can't really manufacture any new proteins that it might need due to changing circumstances because that nucleus is no longer there. So red blood cells die after about 120 days, and then they have to be what? Replaced. So do you think you lose a lot of red blood cells in your body? Okay, like in a second, how many red blood cells do you lose every second? Like 100 or 1,000? 10,000? Okay, you know what? You lose about 2.5 million red blood cells every second. That's a huge number. All right, what do you call that process for the disease when you run out of red blood cells or your red blood cell level starts to decrease below normal? That's anemia. So in order for you not to become anemia, how many red blood cells do you have to make every second? Yeah, the same number that die every second, which is about 2.5 million. So your body is what? A busy place in there. I mean, you think you're busy, but guess what? Your body's even busier replacing, and that's just blood. Okay, so that's the function of mitosis. So when somebody asks you, what's the function of mitosis? Don't just say reproduction, all right? Because mitosis really means reproduction. That's using the same term to answer the question. That really doesn't answer the question. So mitosis is a special form of reproduction for what? Growth and replacement of old and damaged cells. Okay. And the active phase of mitosis starts in prophase, ends in telophase. Interphase really is not a phase of mitosis, that's just a growth phase that happens before mitosis starts. All right, and then you should know some different parts of some key features of these different phases of mitosis. All right, and hopefully in lab everybody went over that. All right, if not, then maybe you have to see me during my office hours. Mitosis is the splitting of your chromosomes into two daughter cells. And what's a good way to think of cytokinesis? If mitosis is the splitting of chromosomes or your genetic material into two daughter cells, what is cytokinesis? It's the splitting of the rest of the cytoplasm into two cells. into two separate daughter cells. So think of mitosis as the splitting of your genetic material into two daughter cells and the splitting of a parent cell into two daughter cells, the organelles or the cytoplasm, as cytokinesis. And in here, think, make sure that you know cytokinesis takes place during the very last phase of mitosis. So one process is embedded in another. But talk to your lab instructor to see if they agree with that. That's a little bit of an oversimplification, but that works in this class for me, in my labs and in my lecture. All right, so cytokinesis is what? The splitting of the cytoplasm into two daughter cells. And mitosis is the splitting of genetic material into two daughter cells. Okay. So that's it for the cell. So make sure you know your organelles and what they look like and what some basic functions of all the organelles are. And you should probably know why fancy cells like what we have making up our body have organelles inside them. And we covered that last time. Okay. All right, so I got one last thought before we move from cells. And that is, I used an analogy of this building as a cell, right, to describe what the function of organelles are. And I said organelles are like rooms in a building that undergo specialized functions. And a building has different rooms so that different functions can happen in one building without interference from each other, right? Okay. All right, so here is another question. So here we have the SCM building with all the rooms in it. What were to happen to the function of the SCM building if all of a sudden we started knocking down walls? If we changed the structure of the SCM building, what would happen to the function of the SCM building? Do you think it would change or not?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's take this wall down right here, and now there might be a physics class over here. We got a physics class and an anatomy class happening at the same time, and no wall between them. All right, so that would be kind of a futile process. So if we change the structure of a building, what happens to the function? It changes. If we change the structure of a cell, guess what happens to the function of the cell? It changes as well. Right? So if we change the structure of a cell or an organ or organ system, what happens to the function? It changes, right? So the structure is fundamental to how things function. So that's, I want you to appreciate that analogy. That's probably pretty important. Okay. All right, so we're going to move on to the next chapter, unless you got some questions on anything. Okay, histology. Oh, I didn't want to do that. Not a bad place to start. Okay. So what the heck is histology? Histology is a scientific study of tissue structure and function. All right, and so what does that mean? What is a tissue? You got to know, you got to go back and work that diagram that shows the structural hierarchy of organization. How do you make a tissue? You put a bunch of cells together, and all those cells should have about the same structure, all right, which means what? They should all have about the same kind of function because they all have about the same kind of building blocks in them. And as a matter of fact, there's something else that's important for understanding tissue. It's not just the cells and what's inside the cells, but some tissues, all right, are determined by what is outside of them. So the cells actually secrete things to the extracellular space or extracellular material. So a tissue is a group of cells with the same structure, which means they have basically the same function, but that the extracellular material surrounding them is the same as well. Right, so we call that the extracellular materials. Now the nice thing about histology that makes it simple is that if you were to point to some place on your body, I could tell you what kind of tissue it is, and there's only four kinds of tissues. That's really nice and simple. And so here are the four kinds of tissues: epithelium, connective, muscle, and nervous tissue. They have a little bit different kinds of functions. We're going to look and see what they are. All right? epithelium makes glands. So I want to just kind of get you oriented in that direction right away. All right, we're going to look at a number of different kinds of connective tissue. There are three kinds of muscle tissue, and there are two general kinds of nervous cells, nervous tissues in our body. So we're going to look at some of these things. All right, so let's start with epithelium first. What are some characteristics of an epithelium? It covers surfaces of the body or lines cavities. Lines cavities or cover surfaces. So guess what organ system has, actually it's the largest organ system in your body, and it covers your body. What is that? That's your integument. And since it's covering a surface, it has to have an epithelium associated with it. All right, so your skin. There's also a lining in the gastrointestinal tract. That's a tube that runs through the inside of your body. And there's also an epithelium that lines every blood vessel, because that's a space, and it lines the inside of the heart. Okay, so epithelium forms glands, and it has very little extracellular material. That means if you have a cell right next to it, right butted up against one cell membrane is another cell membrane, they're going to be cells tightly packed to each other. You probably won't see any extracellular material whatsoever. And so, therefore, it's made mostly of cells. There's hardly any extracellular material whatsoever. Okay, so here is a nice picture of an epithelium. And so here are the epithelial cells. I see three of them. And what do these cells kind of look like to you? They kind of look like cubes, right? These kind of look very, very squarish, right? They have nice sharp corners. And here's the plasma membrane of one cell. Here's the plasma membrane of the other. Very, very little extracellular material in any kind of epithelium. So we say that epithelium will cover a surface or lines a cavity. So here we see a space. This could be open to the outside world, maybe a digestive tract. And then underneath it is the rest of your body. Right, so these cells are lining this particular case, or this space. So this is what we call the apical region of an epithelium, because it's next to, what, some open space over here. This could be the center of a tube. The center of a tube we call the lumen of that particular tube. And then this is the rest of your body. So this is what we call the basal region. Right, and notice that the apical region looks a lot different than the basal region down here. So epithelial cells certainly can be polar. The membranes can be a lot different on the apical surface to the basal surface. And so we got to know which surface is which. Here we see some cilia. We talked about cilia. What's the function of cilia? If you were going to just say one word, it is motility. It's for sweeping, right? So these cilia, for instance, are sweeping mucus on the apical surface of this epithelium. This would be an example of a kind of cell we would find in the trachea, for instance. These over here have these smaller projections, these we call microvilli. These are what we would find maybe in the digestive tract. These enhance absorption. Microvilli enhance absorption. There can be connections between cells. Okay, and we call those certain cell junctions. Some of these cell junctions are just tunnels or passageways for certain ions to move across, as in the example of this gap junction right here. This allows electrical currents to go from one cell to another. That's important for coordinating various kinds of cells. Here's a desmosome. These are strong attachment points so that these cells don't pull apart from each other. And then we have tight junctions closer to the apical surface of this epithelium, and the tight junctions basically just glue the two membranes together so nothing can slip between the cells, right, from the lumen and get into some deeper regions of your body right here. So that's the job of the tight junction and the adherens junction and the gap junction right here. Okay, now let's talk about some strange things about an epithelium. Well, we saw the free surface, that's the apical edge, the basement membrane, that's the basal surface. But an epithelium never contains blood vessels. So that's pretty strange. All right, so on that particular slide, did we see anything that looked like a blood vessel? It was where? Underneath the epithelium. And you know what? On your skin, because that's an epithelium, you probably noticed that a couple times. I hope no one's ever experienced it, but you know what? I bet we all have. Have you ever tried to reach and take hold of a piece of paper, but instead of grabbing it, the edge kind of caught your finger and you got a paper cut? And you go, what happens when you get a paper cut? You go, oh, ow, that really stung, right? And you look expecting to find a big, massive laceration right there. And you look and you go, well, gee whiz, it's not even bleeding, right? So you're not even going to get any sympathy from anybody, right? So what has happened? You got a paper cut through the epithelium and it damaged this nerve, a pain fiber, and you felt the pain, but the paper cut was so, what? How do you call the level? Well, the level is not very, it was so superficial that it never got down to cut this blood vessel down over here. Okay, so epithelium never contains blood vessels, right? Because it's just one epithelial cell next to another, next to another, next to another, next to another. All right, so those are some interesting characteristics. All right, so how do we classify an epithelium? There are two different ways. And one is by the shape of the cell, and the other is by how many layers an epithelium is made up of. The shapes. Let's take a look at the shapes. All right, let's view these as thumbnails. Okay, shapes. Okay, so here we have three general shapes, and I'll show you, I'll give you an example of an atypical shape. And it's coming. I don't know why it's so hard. Maybe I'll close the internet browser down. Maybe I'll go back and try it again. Ah, there it is. Okay. So an epithelium is made up of these cells. They're packed closely together, and you see three different shapes. The first one is a flat cell, and a flat cell we call squamous. As a matter of fact, you're going to find some bones that are flat. You're going to find parts of bones that are flat. So you might find a flat region on a bone, and guess what we named that flat region? That's the squamous region of that particular bone. So a squamous cell is just a cell that looks like a pancake. It is wide and it is deep, but it is not tall at all. That's a flat cell. Or a cell could be cuboidal if it looks like a cube. If the width and depth and height are all the same basic dimension, that's what we call cuboidal. But if there is a cell that is really tall compared to the other two dimensions, that's what we call a columnar cell. So when we look at epithelium, we need to categorize it by one of these three different shapes. And there's a fourth one. The fourth shape is what we call transitional. And that means that it's a shapeshifter. It can change its shape. It might start out looking like a pillow and then end up looking like a squamous cell. So you might want to just jot in transitional. And I'll tell you where we can find transitional cells a little bit later on. Another way that we talk about an epithelium is by layers. And there are only two ways that we talk about layers. If it's just a single layer, right? So here's the apical surface, here's the basal surface, this is the basement membrane of this epithelium. We call it a simple epithelium. But if there are many layers right here, we call that a stratified epithelium. Right? So furthermore, look at the stratified epithelium. These cells down by the basal surface kind of look a little cuboidal maybe because they look kind of tall. But look at these cells on the apical surface. They're what? They're really squamous. So guess how we would name this particular epithelium by shape and by number of layers. We would name it by the shape of the cells on the apical surface. So how would you talk about this particular epithelium by shape and by number of layers? It is a stratified and squamous epithelium, right? And so we'll see that that's the kind of epithelium that helps make our integument up, stratified squamous, because in the apical region, those are stratified cell. I mean squamous cells. Okay. All right, so glands. They could be a single cell, or they could be multicellular. And a gland that's just a single cell is what we call what? A unicellular gland. And glands produce some kind of product and secrete it onto a surface or into a cavity or even into the blood. So glands can have two different kinds of designations depending on where they secrete their product. Should I maybe close that front door? Okay. All right, so a gland is made up of epithelium. We might get interrupted because it's locked. All right, so it's going to secrete maybe a protein or maybe a modified protein, maybe a protein that's been modified by adding a sugar molecule to it or some other kind of molecule. Last time I tried that, my key got stuck. Progress. That's really nice. Okay. So those cells, some cells, just secrete the product into the extracellular space around the cell. And then those molecules diffuse into the blood, the capillary. And then that product is distributed all over the body. That's what we call an endocrine cell. So an endocrine cell just secretes a product that gets picked up by the blood, and the blood distributes it everywhere in the body. And you know what kind of product an endocrine gland secretes? It secretes a hormone, right? So that's really a nice definition of a hormone. It's a chemical that's secreted by an endocrine gland that gets picked up by the blood and distributed all over the body. So it uses the cardiovascular system as a way of distributing that chemical all over the body. The other kind of gland is what we call an exocrine gland. Exocrine glands secrete a product, but not into the blood, into a duct someplace. And that duct carries it to some special part of the body where it's going to function. So a good example of this would be sweat glands that are deep in your integument. Sweat glands produce sweat, but you don't need sweat deep in your integument. Where do you need sweat? On the surface of your skin to cool you down. So there's a duct that carries that water and salt material and some organic material to the surface of your skin to help regulate body temperature. Another good example would be the pancreas. The pancreas is part of your digestive system and it produces digestive enzymes. Do you think it would be a good idea for the pancreas to release digestive enzymes into the pancreas itself? What would happen to the pancreas? It would digest itself away. And so that would be terrible if that were to happen. So the pancreas secretes digestive enzymes into a duct that carry those enzymes to your digestive tract where they work and out of the pancreas so the pancreas doesn't get digested. All right? Unless the pancreas is diseased, unless it has an infection, or if it has cancer, then guess what happens? Those digestive enzymes don't end up where they belong and the pancreas starts to digest itself, and so you can imagine what a terrible situation that is for somebody with pancreatitis or pancreatic cancer. Right? That's a huge problem. The prognosis is always very poor and that disease process progresses very rapidly as a result of that. Right? So that's a big difference between exocrine glands and endocrine glands. So let's look at some types. There could be a single cell. And I have a good example of a single cell exocrine gland for you. Here's it. Oh, good. It came on pretty fast. All right, so here is just a single cell. Here's the nucleus. Here's the apical region. Here's the basal region. And here's some rough there's rough endoplasmic reticulum. You see that here? See all the ribosomes attached to it? And then here is a very active Golgi apparatus. Guess what's the job of a Golgi apparatus again? It's for modifying and packaging. So it takes some proteins from this rough ER, modifies it with a sugar molecule, and it becomes a mucopolysaccharide. Mucose means protein in nature. Saccharide means sugar in nature. So it has these two natures put together. in the Golgi apparatus, and then they're packaged in these vesicles, which migrate up to the apical surface, where they release this product, okay, onto a surface, like a trachea, for instance, or maybe even part of the digestive tract. And that mucopolysaccharide is what we call mucus. Right? So mucus is part protein, part sugar. And what is mucus like? It's really slippery. But it's also something else. It's very hard to digest. So that part that protects your digestive tract from being digested itself. Okay? And so this cell right here, because of its unique shape and because of all this like frothy material right on the apical surface, it's given the name a goblet cell because it kind of looks like a goblet. All right, and they're really easy to see because mucus doesn't pick up any stain. It usually looks kind of very white or transparent underneath the microscope. They're very easy to see as a result of that. So you got to know what that single celled gland is called. The name of that cell is a goblet cell. What does it secrete? It secretes mucus, right? And be able to relate the production of mucus to these organelles you see right here. All right, so here I see a bunch of mitochondria. What does that mean? That protein synthesis requires energy, requires ATP in order for that to happen. Okay. All right, so that's a goblet cell. Oh, let's look at some other kinds of cells, some other kinds of glands. This is probably an exam figure right here. All right, so here is an epithelium. You see this epithelium? It's covering this tissue right here. It's lining the surface. And then it dives deep down into the tissue and it forms this structure. This is a gland. If it's just a simple tube, we call that a simple tubular gland. But if it has branches, that's a simple branch tubular. All right, but instead of being a tube, some glands are more spherically shaped. So alveolar means what? More round, more spherically shaped. So here's a simple alveolar gland, and then here's a simple branched alveolar gland because there are many branches coming off. All right, now what kind of glands are these? Are these endocrine glands or exocrine glands? Could you tell by looking at it? Here is a tube right here. What kind of gland requires a tube? That would be the exocrine. Because if it's endocrine, it just gets secreted outside the cell and then a blood vessel picks it up. But in this particular case, the product of this gland enters this tube and then the tube takes it to wherever it belongs in the body. All right, so the other kinds of glands. If it's tubular, not only can it be simple branched, but if there's branches upon branches, then we call it compound tubular. And if it's alveolar, here is a compound velar. And some of them, I probably won't have this picture for you to see because it's a little confusing. Here's a gland that has, what, an alveolar nature to it, but it also has a tubular nature to it. So this is what, a compound tubulo-alveolar gland. Now that sounds really complicated, but this kind of underscores the use of terminology in anatomy. Remember, we can combine two different terms and use them properly as long as we do what? We put that O between them. All right, so then it's a proper term that everybody would be able to appreciate. Okay, and again, this is what? A nice exocrine gland right here. All right, so we're pretty much done with looking at or talking about epithelium, but now let's look at some different kinds of epithelium. And let's start with this slide right here. All right, so here's a really nice micrograph, and maybe I'll zoom it out a little bit. So here are some tubes that have been cut in cross-section. Okay, you could think of that as maybe a transverse section of that tube. And so we're looking at that tube, what? On edge. We're looking down the tube. The center of any kind of tube, like we have right here, that's what we call the lumen of the tube. It's not labeled on this slide, but we're going to see it labeled on a couple other slides, and so you should just know that terminology. So these are exactly like what you're going to see on the first practicum or very, very similar to them. So I want you to be able to recognize these. And as a matter of fact, if you see a lead line, what's a lead line? This thing right here, that's a lead line. It's pointing to something on a figure. On a practicum, you should be able then to tell me what that lead line is pointing to, right? So we can erase these things and put it on a practicum. Or maybe it might even be on your first lecture test as well. So you have to develop a little eye for these things. All right, so how do you get started with looking at this? Well, how do you even know this is an epithelium? This is what your eye should look for immediately. Look for the basement membrane that separates an epithelium from underlying tissues and structures. So here is an open space, the lumen. We know that there has to be an epithelium associated with it. And then I see this nice, smooth basement membrane right here. So that tells me that this is the apical surface, and this is the basal surface of that epithelium. And so how many layers do I see? It looks just like, and if I look here, it's even more precise. I see just one layer. So how would you talk about this epithelium in terms of layers? It is it's a simple epithelium. Now, we also have to say, in order to completely characterize it, what's the shape of these cells? And this cell right here, that's pretty obvious. It looks like, what? Cuboidal. So here is a simple cuboidal epithelium. And you can see the corresponding illustration over here. All right, so when you see an epithelium, always find that basement membrane. All right, that is very important. It seems like it's so trivial to appreciate, but you know what? Anytime you're looking at an epithelium, right, if this looks to be a jagged edge right here and you have cells poking out of it, right, that's a sign of pathology. Right, so somebody's going to be reading these slides and that could be maybe an example of cancer, of these cells growing uncontrollably beyond the bounds of the tube, breaking through the basement membrane into this tissue right here, which is connective tissue, which is what we're going to start looking at very, very soon. All right, so the slides that I'm showing you don't contain pathology. They should look really nice and normal. The basement membrane should be nice and smooth and well-behaved, and that's just going to define the basal region of that epithelium. Okay. So, next kind of epithelium. It's cut off a little bit, but what do you see right here? It probably is a really nice, outstanding color. This is the basement membrane, and again, it looks really nice and smooth. Here's the lumen of some kind of tube, right? So this, what surface is this right here? This is the apical surface, then here's the basal surface, and basal surface, not labeled on the slide, but you should kind of know that. But on the practicum, what? It's literally going to be these two lead lines right here. You should know what kind of epithelium this is. And it is how many layers from the basement membrane, which is easy to see, to the lumen, how many cells do you see? One. That's a simple epithelium, and the shape is columnar, simple columnar epithelium. Okay. Ah, this one right here. Here is the basement membrane. Underneath it is connective tissue. So this is the basal surface. Here is the apical surface. I see a couple of interesting cells right here, or organelles. I see all these things poking off the top of it. These are actually really long. These are cilia. And so cilia we find, for instance, in the trachea, sweeping debris up out of our respiratory tract all the time. What traps these dust particles on the walls of the trachea? It's got to be mucus from these cells right here. These are what we call goblet cells, right? So goblet cells secrete mucus. The cilia sweep that mucus up out of our respiratory tract, carrying along with it various kinds of debris. Now, when we look at the layers of this epithelium, sometimes it might look like there's a cell that goes all the way from the top, pretty much all the way to the basement membrane, from the apical surface to the basal surface. At other times, what do I see? A couple different layers in there. All right, so this particular epithelium we can't classify as simple or stratified. We call it pseudostratified because it all depends on how you section and how you look at this particular epithelium. All right, so it's pseudostratified and it is also ciliated, and the cells on the apical region are columnar. So a lot of times we call this PSCC, pseudostratified ciliated columnar epithelium. So if you want to be really correct on your test, that's probably what you would say. But I think your lab instructor probably should also just take how it's labeled in your book, which is what? Pseudostratified columnar, right? So make sure you talk to your lab instructor and find out exactly how they want you to answer these things on your practicum. All right, so pseudostratified layer, the nice basement region, and what's underneath the basement membrane that's always going to be? Connective tissue, right. Okay, here's another slide. And what should your eye pick up right away? You should see that there's a lumen, okay, and then find the basement membrane. Here's that nice basement membrane right here. Here's the lumen. So once you see that, then it's really obvious. How many layers are there? Many. So we say stratified. And what's the shape of these cells up over here? It is. They are squamous. So here's a really good example of a stratified squamous epithelium. Okay. See how does it... Is that making sense a little bit? Is your eye picking that up a little bit? Okay. And then underneath the basement membrane, we have connective tissue, right? All right. And then here are just a bunch of nuclei in these cells right here. All right. So this would be a good example of some cells that you looked at in lab, the buccal cells, where we sampled some of these cells from this layer up over here with a toothpick and then stained them and looked at those cells. And maybe you found some other things in there. Who found some other things in there? Like breakfast. Okay. Probably bacteria, because our mouth is not sterile. Okay. We all have bacteria in our mouths. And maybe you even found some of those in lab. Okay. All right. Now, here's another micrograph. Here is a duct from a salivary gland. So this is the lumen that's carrying saliva to our mouth. And then here is the basement membrane right here. Let me zoom in. Right, basement membrane. I'll even zoom in some more. All right. So this is a nice epithelium. What kind of epithelium does that look like to you? It's probably something, even if you didn't memorize the picture, you could probably figure out. How many layers of cells? It's two, so it's got to be stratified, and the shape of these cells look very cube-like. So that's a stratified cuboidal epithelium. Right. Okay. And then, here is another slide of an epithelium, because here is the lumen of some kind of tube, right, or free surface. Here's the apical surface. Here's the basal surface. Here's a nice basement membrane right here, and it looks really nice and healthy. Underlying connective tissue, and how many cell layers does it look like it takes to get from the basal to the apical? Multiple. So it's stratified, and these cells up over here near the apical surface are columnar. So here's an example of a stratified columnar. And don't forget, how many tissues make up your body? Four. They are epithelium, connective tissue, muscle, and nervous. So what is this one right here? Is this epithelium, connective tissue, muscle, or nerve? It's epithelium because it's covering this surface right here. That's what an epithelium does, right? Because here you can see just the free space, right? Could be a lumen of a tube, for instance. All right, so stratified columnar epithelium. And then this is the strange one. This is a strange one. It's easy to see what the basement membrane right here. So here we have connective tissue underneath it. Right, here is the apical or free edge. Right, so here's the free surface. And these cells right here kind of look like pillows. And these kind of look more columnar down over here. All right, so this kind of defies all of our ways that we like to classify an epithelium. You should be able to recognize this as an epithelium, but it's strange. All right, we call this transitional because it's a shapeshifter. It changes shape. it lines an organ that changes shape drastically over the course of a day, right? Because it fills up with urine, okay? And then when you void, the urine leaves and it shrinks back down. So this is what we call a transitional epithelium, lining the urinary bladder. So these cells can get very long and thin and stretched out, okay, when the bladder is full, and then after voiding, those cells get to be columnar or pillow-shaped. So they change their shape depending on the state of fullness of the bladder. That's transitional. I don't have a picture of what these cells look like stretched out. I should Google it and see if I can find something, okay, because they actually change shape. All right, so here is a blood vessel. Here is the heart. And remember, an epithelium lines surfaces or cavities. And the inside of a blood vessel you could think of as a cavity, so it's got to have a lining. This is the epithelium that lines a blood vessel or the chambers of the heart. But since it's lining the inside of the tube, we don't call it an epithelium. We call it an endothelium. Okay? But how would you describe this endothelium to me? How many layers does it look like? Let's see if I can really zoom in. How many layers does it look like? It's just one, so it's a simple. And these cells, do they look columnar? No, they look flat. So it's just a simple squamous epithelium, or maybe even a better way of saying it, just a simple squamous endothelium that lines all your blood vessels and cavities inside the heart. All right, so you know what? We're done with epithelium. And we got a little ways to go yet. So I'll continue, which is good, because you guys have a practicum coming up and I want to review some of these things. All right. The next kind of tissue that we're interested in is connective tissue. And there are different kinds of connective tissue. Connective tissue, we call it connective tissue because it holds cells and various tissues together. It helps attach an epithelium to underlying structures, right? When we looked at epithelium, what was right underneath the epithelium, right deep to an epithelium, that was connective tissue. So connective tissue is going to help glue your skin to underlying structure like muscle and bone. Now the interesting thing about connective tissue, and it's very unlike epithelium. Epithelium had hardly any extracellular space, any extracellular material. But for connective tissue, it has an extensive extracellular space filled with stuff. And as a matter of fact, that's really the most important thing about most connective tissues, is not the cells itself, but the extracellular material. And it's so important that we give it a special name. We call it the matrix. The matrix is all the junk that's outside the cells in a connective tissue that gives connective tissue its particular properties. Okay, so we got a couple general kinds of connective tissue. We've got connective tissue proper, cartilage, bone, and blood. These are all connective tissues. All right, so all of these tissues right here have an extensive what? Matrix. The stuff outside the cell is really what's of prime importance for these kinds of tissues. All right, so the first kind of proper is areolar. Sometimes we call areolar loose connective tissue. So you should get a feel for that it's not extremely strong, right? It's actually kind of what? Loose. It's very, very easy to deform. All right, so we find areolar connective tissue between muscles and glands and nerves in the body. It's very easy to dissect what? Loose connective tissue, because it doesn't glue stuff together very tightly. So it's very easy to separate a nerve from a muscle or neighboring muscles that are next to each other. So when we do dissection, we'll be able to separate muscles out from each other very easily because it's connected together very loosely. There are three kinds of fibers in loose connective tissue. So let me see a good example of a loose connective tissue for you to look at. Here's an illustration of a loose connective tissue. All right, so look, I see a cell here and a cell here and a cell up over here, and can you tell that these cells are far apart? And therefore, since they're far apart, this cannot be what kind of tissue? Can't be an epithelium. All right, what else do we see in here? Do I see a blood vessel? There might be a blood vessel in here. This right here is here is a blood vessel. So that's another dead giveaway that this tissue cannot be epithelium, because epithelium never has a blood vessel going through it. All right, but then the other thing I see right here and here and here and all through over here are fibers. So connective tissues usually are loaded with fibers that are found where? Inside the cell or outside? Yeah, they're outside the cell, and what do we call that space? That's a special name. We call it the matrix. So connective tissues have these fibers in the matrix. And you can see that some of them are thick, and some are thin, and some are extremely thin. The thick ones right here are made out of a chemical compound we call collagen. So collagen is extracellular. It's thick and it's strong. You should think of collagen as being like a steel fiber, a steel cable. It just won't stretch. All right, so it gives your body a lot of support. Does anybody know another kind of fiber? It's like a thread that's even stronger than steel. Anybody know a thread that's even stronger than... It's a man-made fiber. Okay. And it's even used to weave pressure tanks for like scuba diving, and firemen carry it around that can be pressurized. They carry oxygen with them. It's called Kevlar. So you should think of collagen as like being Kevlar. It's a super strong fiber. You can't pull it apart, okay, from end to end. Another kind of fiber that we have in connective tissue is this elastic fiber, and you can see it's thinner. And elastic has a different kind of property. What's an interesting property of elastic fibers? It can stretch. And then when the tension is released, what happens to that fiber? It goes back to the original length. So you have some parts of your body that need to deform or stretch, and when that tension is released, what happens to your body? It goes back to its original kind of shape. But since it's weaker, those fibers can be damaged if they're overstretched. All right, so we're going to see some tissues that have elastic properties. And then the weakest kind of fiber are these reticular fibers. All right, so they give that kind of connective tissue a little strength, but it can be what? Easily damaged. It can be pulled apart very easily. So we have unfortunately, some glands in our body, or organs, some organs in our body that are primarily reticular in nature. So that means that they can be easily damaged. Does anybody know an organ in your body that can be damaged very easily by trauma? And guess what? Now you could guess what kind of fibers it has holding it together. And that would be, somebody said spleen. That's exactly what I was thinking of. A spleen can be damaged very easily to blunt trauma, car accident, bicycle, motorcycle accident, okay? Because it's held together only with reticular fibers. Okay. The kinds of cells, so those are the kinds of chemicals I want you to know, collagen, elastic fibers, and reticular fibers, they're secreted by a particular cell that secretes fibers into the matrix. Guess what we call that cell? That's what we call a fibroblast. A fibroblast secretes fibers into the matrix. So here's a case in anatomy where that makes perfect sense. We don't really change the name around very much. A fibroblast secretes fiber into the matrix. All right, so the matrix, which is all the stuff outside of cells, has fibers in it, but it also has something else. It has ground substance. It's more like a fluid-like material. And it can have protein sugar molecules in it. All right, but it's much more fluid compared to these fibers over here. All right, so in loose connective tissue, you can even have a nerve fiber passing through it. You can have blood vessels passing through it. It's got all these different kinds of fibers. Plus, it can have a number of different kinds of white blood cells that are going to fight infection. So here we see some different kinds of white blood cells, like a lymphocyte, neutrophil, plasma cell. And areolar connective tissue can even have cells that store fat. You could call them fat cells, but a better term would be adipocyte, because a more proper name for fat is adipose. Right, so adipocyte, fat cell, pretty much the same thing. So here's a typical kind of reticular fiber, a reticular connective tissue. But when we look underneath the microscope, this is what we're going to see. All right, so maybe you would expect to see this particular picture on a practicum. And how would you know that this is not an epithelium? How do you know this is not an epithelium? The cells are far apart, right? And you see extensive matrix, and you see a lot of fibers crisscrossing all over the place, right? I don't see a basement membrane. I don't see a free edge. I don't see apical surface or basement membrane, right? So it's really easy for me to tell. Now, how would I recognize this as being loose connective tissue or areolar? When I see areolar connective tissue, it kind of looks like a stained glass window to me. I see all kinds of nice fractured lines in there, sharp angles all over the place. All right, so that's how I know this is loose connective tissue when I look at it. Here's a fibroblast, or the nucleus of a fibroblast. These thick fibers right here are, is that labeled? Yeah, they're labeled. What are these? These are the collagen fibers. They're going to resist stretch, and loose connective tissue can resist a little bit of stretch in all different kinds of directions because these fibers are oriented in all different directions. And it even has some elastic tissues right here, elastic fibers made out of elastin. All right, so that's nice. That means that this tissue can stretch, and then it will go back as long as you don't overstretch it. Okay, so loose connective tissue. I'm going to come back to this one in a little bit. Here is one that has these fibers stained very, very darkly. These are highly branched. Oh, I'm going to go back two slides. Look at these collagen fibers. How could you describe this collagen fiber to me? Is it branched or is it straight, linear? It's straight. It's just a linear molecule. It's a fiber. These reticular fibers are what? Have a lot of branching to them. They're really thin. They're easily damaged. So reticular connective tissue is what makes up the spleen right here. Reticular fibers in the pictures we show you will stain very, very dark. And again, you know this is not an epithelium. Why? Because there's a big space between the cells right here. It has a matrix. All right, so reticular connective tissue. Let's go to this one right here. Another kind. Here is a cell that's secreting these fibers into the matrix. And these fibers are the really, really strong ones. These are the collagen fibers. And look at the orientation of these collagen. Are they all oriented all kinds of different angles? Or are they all lined up on top of each other? Basically, they're all on top of each other. So this is the strongest kind of connective tissue. It is almost impossible to stretch it from end to end because collagen just packs the matrix nice and tight. This is what we call dense regular connective tissue, and it makes tendons and ligaments in your body. All right, so here are, what kind of cells make this collagen and secrete it into the matrix? These are fibroblasts. All right, they're far apart, therefore you know that it is connective tissue. Now, do you see any blood vessels in here? Nope, no blood vessels. So when you damage a tendon or a ligament, guess what? Its recuperative ability is pretty small because it doesn't have blood. It doesn't have nutrients to rebuild itself. It takes a long time to rebuild tendons and ligaments as a result of that. But nonetheless, because of all these fibers, all these like Kevlar fibers, steel fibers right here, it's tough to damage a tendon, at least when you pull it from end to end. But if you pull it from top to bottom, guess what you can do? You can separate these layers out fairly easily. So dense, regular connective tissue is strong end to end, but it's relatively weak from side to side. So if you use a joint properly, it's difficult to injure a tendon and a ligament. But if you bend a joint in an improper motion, like twisting an ankle, guess what happens? The tendons and ligaments can separate in the middle, and then it's relatively easy to damage a tendon and a ligament that way. All right. So we see here is a tendon and here is a ligament, for instance, in the shoulder joint. A similar kind of connective tissue that's loaded with collagen, but it's oriented in more directions than just, say, right and left that we see for a tendon, is the previous slide. All right, so what we're looking at is collagen, but which way is it going? It's going all over the place. And this is what we call dense, irregular connective tissue. It is strong. It can resist tension in all kinds of directions, but not nearly as strong as dense, regular connective tissue in that one direction that it is designed to withstand tension in. All right, so parts of your body that have dense, irregular connective tissue are capsules around joints. Those have to be really strong and withstand tension in all kinds of different directions, but not in one particular direction. So it can be damaged a little bit more easily compared to a tendon or a ligament. All right, so what would you call these cells right here? These are fibroblasts because they secrete collagen. Now, what kind of tissue is this? Would you say epithelium or connective tissue? Connective tissue. Why would you say connective tissue? Because the cells are far apart, and I don't see a basement membrane. I don't see an apical surface or a free edge, right? That's just a connective tissue. And collagen is in the matrix of this particular kind of connective tissue. Okay. Here is, we got three slides of that are just little specializations of this kind of connective tissue. How do you know this is connective tissue? Cells are far apart, no basement membrane, right? No free edge. Here are some cells. Here is a cell, here's a nucleus, and here's a cell, and it's in this little bubble. And then here's another one. Here's a cell in a little bubble. So guess what? This is not an artifact of preparation. This is an actual situation. Right, when we see cells inside these little bubbles right here, it can be one of two kinds of connective tissue. It can be cartilage or it could be bone. And these little bubbles are what we call lacunae. One is a lacuna. Lacunae are what? Like little lagoons or pits within this kind of connective tissue that hold the cell. And since this cell is responsible for making cartilage, we use the name cartilage to tell us what kind of cell it is. So anytime you hear that term chondro or chondrocyte, you should think of cartilage. Oh, here it is right here. So chondro has to do with cartilage. Chondrocyte is a cartilage cell. This is a cell that makes cartilage, and it secretes that cartilage into the matrix right here. Now, when you look at that matrix in this kind of cartilage, do you see any fibers whatsoever? No. And so this is a specific kind of cartilage that doesn't have fibers in it. All right, it just has really nice ground substance. We call this hyaline cartilage. It's the least strong of all the cartilages because it has no fibers in the matrix whatsoever. All right, some examples of where you would find hyaline cartilage would be the covering of the ends of bones for articulations, and also cartilage in the rib cage. All right, so this is a kind of cartilage that can deform very nicely. It can bend, which is one really nice thing about cartilage. Right? It can bend and then go back to its normal shape. All right, so when I look at cartilage, I just kind of see a random speckle pattern of cells inside these lacunae right here. And if I don't see any fibers, I know it is hyaline cartilage. The next kind of cartilage. Right, and the reason why I know this is cartilage, again, is because I see lacunae with cells inside of it. And these are chondrocytes. But now, what do I see in the matrix right here? I see some fibers. So could that be hyaline cartilage?
No.
Can't be hyaline. It's got to be some other kind. And these fibers have a lot of branching associated with them. These are elastic fibers. So this is the kind of cartilage that is a lot lighter than bone, but it has a certain kind of shape. You can bend it out of shape, and then when you let go, what happens to it? It goes back to its original location. Like you can bend your ear and then let it go, what's going to happen? The elastic fibers are going to pull it back into shape. But remember, these elastic fibers are not super strong. So you can damage your ear, right? Like if you're a boxer and somebody punches you in the side of the head all the time, right? You can damage those cells and the matrix, and you can end up with a big deformed ear that we call a cauliflower ear as a result of that, okay? Okay. Because elastic fibers are not nearly as strong as, say, collagen fibers. All right, so guess what? You do have some collagen or some cartilage in your body that has collagen. It's cartilage that is very strong, and we call that fibrocartilage. Here's what fibrocartilage looks like. All right, and again, you know this is cartilage because I see, what are the names of these cells? These are chondrocytes, meaning cartilage cell, chondrocyte and cartilage cell, and I see a lacuna right here. But now I see all these parallel strands of thick fibers. That's collagen. So this kind of cartilage can withstand more force than hyaline or elastic cartilage, so we find it in parts of your body that need a lot of strength. Like, for instance, certain parts of the intervertebral discs that are being crushed all the time. Every time you stand up, right, the vertebrae is pushing down on the one below it, and to help protect the vertebrae, there's cartilage between them, but that cartilage has to be tough and strong, and that's fibrocartilage. All right, so it's a good example of fibrocartilage. Also, another good example, probably you all have heard of knee meniscus. It's a special piece of cartilage within your knee joint, and guess what kind of cartilage that is? A meniscus. You think it should be weak or it should be tough? It should be tough, and that's a fibrocartilage as well. Knee meniscus is made out of fibrocartilage, and underneath the microscope, if it's healthy, it's going to look just like that. All right, and if it's unhealthy, what are you going to see? You're going to see big separations between these cartilage filaments right here with filled up with fluid, right? That means that meniscus has been torn, for instance. All right, so this is just an example of a nice, healthy fibrocartilage. All right, this one is really easy to see. So those are the three kinds of cartilages, okay? What's the name of the cell that we find in cartilage? Is the chondro, right? Chondro means cartilage, chondrocyte. Guess what cyte means? That means just means cell, right? So it means literally a cartilage cell. And the three kinds of cartilage, the hyaline with no fibers, elastic with those branched fibers, and fibrocartilage if it's really loaded with fibers. So here is a tissue that is similar to cartilage. And it's similar because I see little bubbles within the matrix that holds cells. And those are called lacunae as well. All right, but now look at the arrangement of this one. This almost reminds me of a botany class. Why is that? Because when I look at that, it almost looks like a cross-section of a tree limb, right, or a stem of a plant or something. And you see these rings, right? They kind of look like growth rings in a plant, but this is actually from a human body. This is a micrograph of what bone, or how bone is made, compact bone. It's made tubes within side tubes within side tubes, right? Layers within layers, and that makes bone really strong in terms of compression. It's what gives bone a lot of strength. So here is not a cell. Right, so I know this is not an epithelium. This is actually a connective tissue because of the matrix. Now, what is special about this matrix right here? Probably you all know something about that. What's in the matrix? There's got to be a metal ion that gives bone a lot of strength, and that metal ion is calcium. Yeah, calcium really is a metal. It's incorporated into bone to give bone a lot of strength. We'll talk more about that when we get into the bone chapter. All right? But whenever you see rings upon rings upon rings, that's got to be bone. And the cells that make up bone can't be chondrocytes because chondrocytes are found in cartilage. So the term that we use for bone is osteo. All right? Osteo has to do with bone. So these are osteocytes. Right? Bone cells right here. So an osteocyte is a mature bone cell. So this is a picture of mature bone. In the very center of all these structures, we see some blood vessels because these cells are alive. and they need oxygen and nutrients to maintain your bones. And how long do you keep your skeleton for? Okay, like that column, that concrete column we have right here in the room, how long has that been there? Since the building was built. How long will it stay there? Exactly like that, until somebody, knocks the building down, right? That doesn't change ever. Now, that's not like your bones in your body. You can think of them because it's supporting the building, your bones support your body, but the bones in your body are a lot different than that column because they have, what am I pointing to right here? What are those things? Those are osteocytes. They're alive, right? They're maintaining the bone. These things rebuild your bones every 5 years. You have new bones every 5 years in your body, right? So, again, you're very dynamic because of these living cells. And if you change activity levels, guess what happens to your bones? I'll use an analogy. Say, I have this biceps brachii right here, and I walk around with a 5-pound sack of potatoes, and all day long I do this. Okay, what happens to that biceps besides getting really tired at the end of the day? It's going to get huge and big, right? It's going to hypertrophy. It's going to feel that stress, and it's going to modify itself to handle that stress. All right? Now, this bone right here is alive too. And guess what happens when we start to stress a bone? Guess what happens to it? Just like that muscle, it gets bigger and stronger as well. All right? It responds to that stress by getting bigger and stronger, just like a muscle does. Right? So if you don't do any exercise, what happens to your bones? Just like if you don't do any exercise, all right, I don't want to show my arm. I should show somebody else's arm. Okay, what happens to that biceps if you never use it? It gets smaller and smaller and smaller. It atrophies. Well, guess what? If you don't exercise, guess what happens to your bones? They get smaller and weaker too. All right, so that's just, I'm going to mention that point a little bit later on in the class. All right, so we've kind of got started with this topic here. We got a couple more connective tissues to talk about, and then we got to review connective tissues a lot next time. So make sure you do your pre-lecture reading assignment, and also make sure you sign the sign-in sheet because I don't want anybody to get dropped in here. All right, make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. I'll leave it right here on the table.